Just after 1 o'clock on Sportsnet 590, the Fan, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you on a Wednesday afternoon. Smith and Jones hits the air as we get set for, well, more postseason playoff action, Jonesy. It's unfortunate that we've only got the one sport to talk about, and that's with due respect to baseball and to baseball fans out there. But as we come to a close, obviously, over the last couple of weeks to the NBA and the NHL, we are full bore into Major League Baseball postseason because we're not going to have a whole lot else for the next few months outside of the National Football yeah. League as we continue to try and figure out when the sports world gets back to its next seasons, obviously that puts a little bit more focus and attention on baseball for the time being, and certainly a heck of a showing for Clayton Kershaw, as a lot of people were waiting to see. That he's had a lot of critics over the years in terms of what he mm-hmm. is in the regular season versus what he is come postseason, and I think he silenced a ton of the critics in Game 1, and a little bit of momentum maybe now for the Dodgers heading into Game 2.
Okay, first off, let me start with the fact that you and I feel like a conspiracy theory here on. You and Marchese strategically navigated around yesterday's show so that both of you who are Buffalo Bills fan did not have to talk about that butt whooping that the Kansas City Chiefs laid on you guys. I mean, they were running the ball like they were running against practice tackle dummies that couldn't move at one point. Like, the young man from LSU, Edwards-Helaire, was like career high in rushing. He's over 160, almost 170 yards at one point. And I just thought, okay, I'm going to get my licks in because my Browns got destroyed on Sunday. All right. It's still the unofficial show of nobody. And if we could borrow that from Ernie Johnson, sponsored by nobody. But Mahomes wasn't even like, I'm used to that guy slinging it all over behind the back, underhand, over the neck. All I'm doing is waiting for the Globetrotter music, and they ran the ball. And with that, I got to give Josh Allen some credit. In spite of the last drive, the drive that brought them back to within one score, like, he moved them down the field pretty quickly. So I, you know what, I'm growing a soft spot for the young man. But I just thought it was interesting that I didn't get one lick in, like not one, I didn't get to tee my ball up once and use the driver yesterday against the Bills. I got to wait till the back nine.
Yeah, and clearly you had it top of mind today because you didn't even talk to me and didn't even answer my query, my statement about the Dodgers and Rays. You just ignored baseball and went right to the Buffalo Bills.
I'll get to that.
I promise you I was going to bring it up today, but think about yesterday. Right out of the gate, we talked to George Karl, then we had Paul Westhead. We were trying to get in the conversation about the favorite players of all time, and that sort of got us off track a little bit, so we didn't even get to the football. But the only thing I would disagree with slightly, just slightly, when you said butt whooping, because they did get their butts whooped, but as crazy as it was a game that was still there for the taking. And in that fourth quarter when the Bills had KC at 3rd and 12, and they gave up like a 35, 37-yard first down. That was it right there. But they're down 6, a chance to get the ball back off a KC punt, and they allow a huge first down on that 3rd and long, and that was the backbreaker right there because they did not deserve to be in that game. You're right. They were getting the ball run up there both ends, both sides, all day, all evening. And that's been an issue for Buffalo this year. That's the one problem I have with this team, Jonesy, and I think it's a big one, is even when they were 4-0, and I was sitting pretty and talking a lot of junk, they hadn't played necessarily world beaters. And now back-to-back weeks, they've played two very good teams in Tennessee and Kansas City, lost both, and their defense looks nowhere near what it looked like last year, let alone the year before, and that's where they've made their name. So as much as their offense has improved and Josh Allen looks good and Diggs looks good and everything else, if it's coming to the detriment of the defense or at the expense of the defense, man, they got to find a way to balance this out. I was talking to our friend Jacko yesterday. You know that he's a big Bills fan, obviously, as well. And one of the things we're saying is when you look at this team, the Bills, suddenly Tom Brady is down in Tampa. And that's a great thing for the AFC if you're the Buffalo Bills. Let alone if you're the Jets or the Dolphins or the new makeshift Patriots. But Tom Brady's gone, and out of nowhere, the AFC is stacked. We were just talking about that yesterday or 2 days ago, weren't we? with Frank Schwab. It's like suddenly now the AFC is a beast. So you get rid of Tom Brady, but it's like Pittsburgh, Tennessee, Kansas City, throw Buffalo maybe into the mix. There's so many good teams now in the AFC. It's not going to be easy for anybody. Baltimore, somebody's going to have to, you know, be bounced in round one, let alone round two, and it's going to be a real tough grind to be the one left standing in the AFC this year. And did I lose Jonesy? Now maybe I lost Jonesy. I gave nice little rant about the Bills, and I allowed to tee it up. He said he wanted to pull out the driver and hit it down center, right down the middle of the fairway, and then he's gone. Yeah, I got him so fired up that the line dropped, I suppose. So now, don't allow him to go back to the Buffalo Bills, boys. If he starts talking Bills, we move on from that. We've talked enough Bills. Yes, I'm still licking my wounds. And then how do we lick our wounds as football fans? Well, we have to lick them even longer until Sunday because nobody's watching the game tomorrow night, right? I mean, does anybody care about a Thursday nighter between the Giants and the Eagles? It's incredibly ridiculous that the 2-4 Dallas Cowboys, with all of the issues coming out of Big D, are a first-place team and a playoff seed right now. I mean, I know we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago on our show. There was a 7-9 playoff team in football just a couple of years ago. The Seattle Seahawks at 7-9 made the playoffs. But gosh, if we see the Cowboys finish like with 5 wins, 6 wins or something and into the postseason, that's a joke. And I can't imagine anybody's going to be wanting to watch the Eagles and Giants tomorrow night in just a battle of two teams going absolutely nowhere. And Jonesy is back.
Yeah, it is football. It's a channel stopper. People will bet on it, and people will watch. And I agree with your sentiments about your Buffalo Bills defense, you and Jacko, the fact that the offense has been carrying them. But the good thing is it's only week 6, week 7. You still got time to improve it, and you know, the measuring sticks against good teams. So you know, that's a good thing. That is a good thing. And well, we'll see. We'll see who prevails this weekend between the Brownies and the Bills. It's like they're playing each other every week through you and I. It's like, you know, on radio fantasy football. And as for the Dodgers, where you started the show, somewhere my late father is looking down and saying, okay, I can give, because he was all over Kershaw for not being able to perform in big games. And he was, like you said, he was really good last night. Gave up 2 hits, 8 strikeouts, only 1 walk. I wish I could talk to my dad right now and say, Dad, Kershaw, Darvish, like the Astros knew every pitch that was coming, Dad. That's why they hit it.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
knew everything that was coming. So give the guy a break. Give the guy a break. But the Dodgers looked good last night, and Mookie Betts looked good last night, too. You know what I really like, E? That guys are themselves, their personalities. I mean, they're hitting home runs, and, you know, back in the day, you just kind of lower your head and run around the bases as fast as you can. Bellinger hit one that might land in your soup in about and, you know, the guys are having fun out there. And the thing is, you talked about sports and this time of year. Baseball is the only sport that's really on its true timetable.
Yeah.
I mean, they shortened the season. You know, it's the middle of October and we're watching baseball. And in fact, I think it'll end before it did the last few years right now. So good for them. We got lots to talk about with the NFL. We can still guess at hockey and basketball. And I mean, I know it's going to be particularly tough for you and I, because I think it was a year ago tomorrow that it was ring night at Scotiabank Arena.
Right.
Somebody can check that, but I seem to see some of my photos coming up from October 22nd. I could be wrong. Maybe it was later down the line, but yeah, we're going to have to wait and see. And there's nothing. We know when the draft is, but we don't know anything about the salary cap, about free agency. Like, I'm hearing people say, oh, the Raptors could offer Fred VanVleet this much, or teams can offer him that much. How do you know? The
Nobody
cap hasn't
right
been
now.
Set.
Exactly.
Nobody knows. So you're all guessing, you know? So,
well, it's like yesterday, Jonesy, and I don't know how much we're going to get into it here over the course of the show, but I sent it to you and Marchese in our little group chat on our show chat yesterday, the top 10. And admittedly, the way ESPN phrased it. It was their way too early power rankings. Well, yeah, no kidding, way too early. We don't even know when the season's going to start. We don't know if it's February 1st, March 1st. We don't know if it's going to be 82 games or 66 games or 50 games or what it might be. And you're putting out power rankings before free agency even comes out. And you don't have the top 10 doesn't include the Toronto Raptors at all. I mean, based on what? You think that the Raptors are going to fall out of the top 10 simply because they're another year experience? Like, listen, if they end up losing Fred VanVleet, if they end up losing Serge Ibaka, if they don't have Marc Gasol back, all right, maybe I'll listen to a case. But you can't tell me that they're not a top four, top five team still in the Eastern Conference, let alone a top 10 team in the NBA, and you're still giving love all these years later to the Philadelphia 76ers, who continue to disappoint, especially this year's disappointment. And why? Just because they have Doc Rivers, they're going to be suddenly that much different or that much better? I was beyond annoyed, but then I recognized when I saw it, this is clickbait. Don't fall into the clickbait. Don't be pulled into this. And that's why I know we didn't even book a guest to talk about this, because it's not worth the more than 90 seconds of why ESPN doesn't think the Raptors are a top 10 team.
Well, we'll see how they do on the court. That's all we can say. I mean, like last year, people kept looking at the Raptors to fall apart, and they continued to play well, and so well that Nick Nurse now has a coaching tree. You know, Adrian Griffin, Nate Bjorkman has a job. People are looking at the Raptors, and it happens all the time. When you are successful and you've come from the rubble, people want to know, how did you do that? Like, hire their assistant GM or hire their assistant coach or hire one of their, you know, vice presidents of player development or something. Get into that organization and see what they did. And the Pacers did that with Bjorkman.
Well, speaking of Nate Bjorkman, the new head coach of the Indiana Pacers, he had his press conference via Zoom, the distance press conference, about 2 hours ago in Indianapolis. And to talk about the hiring in Indy, as Nate McMillan is out and Nate Bjorkman is in, from the Indiana Pacers broadcast, their TV sideline reporter, Jeremiah Johnson. Jeremiah, thanks for the time today.
I'm always happy to join. And before we get into Nate, I heard your talk there about power rankings. There are a lot of similarities between the Pacers and Raptors, because the Pacers are never ranked in anybody's top 10, and normally it's the top five in the East, and even though they could be third or fourth at the time, they're usually sixth or seventh when anybody discusses them. So a lot of similarities, and now we're just sharing coaches.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Listen, Jeremiah, it was about a month ago, almost to the day, Nick Nurse was on a Zoom call. I can't even remember what it was for, if it was wrapping up the bubble or whatever the heck it was. And he just happened to mention, I don't even know if he was asked directly, but he happened to mention that Nate Bjorkman has been in Indianapolis, has interviewed for the Pacers job, and I think he's one of the finalists. And I think a lot of us on the call were thinking, what the heck? We didn't know about that. If there was one assistant we've heard a lot of noise about in this offseason, it was Adrian Griffin more than any other. How did this come together for the Pacers when they were linked to a lot of other bigger names, quote-unquote, and ultimately Nate Bjorkman as an assistant not only interviews for the job but impresses enough and ultimately lands the job?
Well, a little perspective on usually the way things work in Indiana is the rumors or the reports are usually not in what ends up happening. I mean, just go back most recently to that Paul George trade. I mean, there were all these, you know, prospective rumors of who the Pacers could get, and I never once heard about Victor Oladipo and Domantas Sabonis. So this, you know, coaching search was a little bit unusual to start with because there were so many names out there, and I did find it not concerning, but I really didn't understand, because normally this is a franchise that keeps things so close to the vest, and you were hearing them. You know, they weren't announcing it, but you could tell that Woj and Shams, they were getting it from, you know, well-sourced people. But there was 12 to 15 names that were supposedly candidates. And it's never been this franchise's MO to put it out there or to say, well, yeah, that's who they're going to pick. Same thing happens on draft night. Whoever you hear might be on their radar is rarely who they end up picking. And so it does kind of fit that, you know, they weren't going out of their way to let everybody know about someone who was such a good candidate. Maybe they didn't want to let anyone else know about this person that maybe they felt like they uncovered a little bit. So I'll credit Nick Nurse for, you know, breaking that news, but also having, you know, the trust in Nate that he maybe was endorsing him as much as anything in that time to say, this is someone who's ready for this opportunity. I'm sure he doesn't want to lose him, but he also knows the time is now, and Nate deserved that opportunity. So I don't know all of the inner workings, and it's harder even now in the Zoom era to really know what was happening behind the scenes. But I do think they knew they had a little bit of a diamond in the rough there, and maybe they were happy to let everybody know many of their candidates, but they didn't want everybody to know maybe their top candidate.
Jeremiah, I guess I want to back up a little bit. I was really surprised when Nate McMillan was let go. I thought he did a really good job without Oladipo, and then, you know, the bubble, it really kind of, I wouldn't even say exposes things. It was very artificial, and I just thought, you know, some teams came ready to play. I mean, it was like having a season within the off season, an off season within the main season, and then you get there, and it takes teams time to kind of crank up again, and you were expected to go full speed. I was really kind of like, were you surprised that move was made with Nate McMillan initially?
Paul, I definitely was surprised. And, you know, now you can see how maybe it all makes sense. And on a day like today, when you hear from Nate Bjorkgren and you see his vision, you can see how it makes sense. But I was surprised. First of all, you think back to the seeding games and the Pacers announced an extension for Nate McMillan. And you can talk about the bubble being unkind to the Pacers, but they were 6-2 in those seeding games playing without DeMontis Sabonis. So they were actually one of the teams that came into that prepared and ready. They seemed to have good chemistry. But the overriding factor was, I think, the last 2 years of playoffs. You combine what happened against the Miami Heat with that series against the Boston Celtics. And to be swept on what is the biggest stage, it's what you work 12 months a year for that week or two in the postseason to see what you have. And to back-to-back years be swept, and as Kevin Pritchard has said since the season ended, he never really even felt like watching those games that there was a chance the Pacers could win. And I think that was concerning. So was it maybe a bit unfair to Nate and his staff to judge them on that week and a half that they didn't have their all-star and they had their other all-star a little bit of a shell of himself, to be perfectly honest? Perhaps. But this is kind of a results-based business. And if you saw enough in that week and a half, and the front office was actually inside the inner bubble the entire time. So maybe they saw some things off the court, chemistry-wise. Maybe they had some conversations with players that were a little bit of a red flag to where they just felt like they needed to make a change. So Nate did an outstanding job. You will never find me saying anything bad about him. But there are some similarities to Toronto, right? I mean, Dwayne Casey was Coach of the Year, and he was let go. Yeah. It looks like it was a smart move, or it was Nick Nurse was definitely ready for the opportunity. But there are a lot of parallels here that cannot be ignored.
Speaking with Jeremiah Johnson from the Pacers broadcast crew, he's their TV sideline reporter. Jeremiah, when you look at Nate Bjorkman coming in, correct me if I'm wrong, we don't know when the season's actually going to start. We assume it's not anywhere in this current calendar year, whether it's January 1st, February 1st, March 1st, whenever it may be. Do you assume right now that the team on paper is going to look pretty damn close to the team that's there right now? Is Nate going to be moving forward with for the most part, the same core that the Pacers have as we speak this very second?
Well, if you asked me a month and a half ago, I would have said the other Nate would have been here next year with an entire roster that was very similar, maybe with the exception of you would have done something with one of the bigs if you determined through your evaluation that it didn't work well. But now that there's a new coach, and really, let's go back to the beginning of last season. I viewed it as a two-year run because I did think that staff had a couple of years of an opportunity to kind of maybe win one series this past season and then really make their run next season. They had a lot of guys who were under contract for the following season, so you didn't need to shake it all up. Continuity is something that I think Kevin Pritchard values more now than he did in his days in Portland. However, now there's a new coach. There's a little bit of a new vision. There's a style, and there's a embracing the three-point shot and the analytics. Well, the Pacers have not been a big three-point shooting team over the years, and it's not because they haven't wanted to shoot more threes, but I'm not sure they've had the personnel that really fit that kind of team. So it would make sense with the guys under contract and everything Nate said today of his communication level already with guys like Victor Oladipo and Miles Turner that they'll bring back a similar roster. But I don't know. The next month and a half could be crazy in the NBA. And to ask to say, oh, yeah, they'll for sure run it all back, I almost would be surprised if there isn't a little bit of change.
Jeremiah, how much pressure do you think is on the new Nate? Because, I mean, this team, I don't think anybody expected a lot of them last year. They played well, especially without Victor. I thought Sabonis was absolutely fantastic. And it seemed like within the season, the expectations ramped up. And that might have led to, as you pointed out, the firing of Nate McMillan, and you bring in a new coach. What kind of pressure? Gauge the pressure meter for me in terms of not just making the playoffs, but how far they need to go, because it seems like the expectations changed partway through the season on them.
Well, this is a team and an organization that has had a little bit of turnover. I mean, even maybe Larry Bird was famous for saying, you know, players tune coaches out in 3 or 4 years. But I get the feeling that they want this to be a long-term thing. So they're not going to just base everything on what happens next season and the pressure is on Nate to win a series or else. I mean, that was Nate Millen's pressure. He really thought if he didn't win a playoff series this past season, he would be moving on. But the bubble and the pandemic changed it to where I think he thought he was safe, and he probably would have been safe if they had been more competitive against the Heat. But to answer your question, 4 seed, 5 seed, that's where this team has been each of the last 3 seasons. So I don't think anyone would expect him to fall off much from that. If they're a 7 or an 8 seed and they're not competitive, then all of a sudden it gets your tenure gets evaluated under scrutiny, you know, quite quickly. But the main thing that this team wants to experience is postseason success. This is an organization that the ownership is the same from the 90s. And people around here love Pacers basketball in late May when the Indy 500 is going on at the same time. Well, they did actually have Pacers basketball in the Indy 500 this past season, but it was only because it was August and it was seeding games and the movement of the 500. So this fan base just wants to experience any level of postseason success. So I don't think this coaching staff will be evaluated on a November game or what happens, or actually I can't even say November now, January or a February game. If they can get into a playoff series, you know, win a couple games, feel like that they are in a position to advance or even do advance, that's really what they need to do. And I think everybody will allow them to, you know, ease into the season a little bit. It's easy to say now because a bad week and everyone can get upset. But the pressure is just about the postseason and not to necessarily win a championship next year, but to move on from what's happened the last 3 years, which, you know, two of them have been very painful.
Speaking with Pacers broadcaster Jeremiah Johnson. Jeremiah, I think we could probably put Toronto in the mix, even though they won a championship now 2 seasons ago. When we look at just the three of us talking, when we look at what the Miami Heat did, there's no denying they have young talent, good young talent. There's no denying a star in Jimmy Butler. But do you think that a Pacers team, Raptors, other squads in the East, do they look at that and kind of say, hey, why not us? If Miami can do it, why not us? Because as good as Jimmy Butler is, and maybe I'm guilty here of maybe still, after everything, not giving Jimmy Butler as much credit as perhaps I should, do you think teams look at it and say, listen, there is no LeBron James in the East. Giannis may or may not be long in Milwaukee. If they can do it, why not us? Why don't we look at it and say the East could be ours?
And that was probably part of the biggest frustration with the Nate McMillan era, was the team was good, but they could never really experience any postseason success. And you see a team like Toronto win the championship. And even what maybe more similar is what the Raptors were able to do this past season without the Kawhi Leonard. And then you look at the Miami Heat and you say, well, yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, if you could say, especially pre-injury, Victor Oladipo and Jimmy Butler, is there that much big of a difference in terms of star power, you know, 2 years ago from those two players? Now, they're a little bit of a different personality, and I think Jimmy Butler had the kind of impact on his team this season that Victor did in that first season in Indiana. But I definitely think there's some merit to what you're saying, and it's probably a reason they waited so long for this coaching hire, because I do believe, and it was widely reported, that they wanted to talk to some of those Miami Heat assistant coaches. So they had an opportunity to talk to the Raptors staff and anyone they wanted to from Toronto once they were eliminated, but you don't really bother the Miami staff until they're finished. So they did their due diligence. They interviewed a number of candidates, and those two fan bases, or I should say those two franchises, the Heat and the Raptors, are something that the Pacers strive to beat. They want to be in the finals. They want to win a championship, and those two franchises have shown it is possible without a top five player. Well, you did it. Kawhi Leonard is in the top five, but I mean, yeah, what the Raptors did this past season, I think, is all the proof you need from a Pacers perspective to know that it is possible.
Jeremiah, how much are we talk about the similarities between Toronto and Indiana? how much are the Pacers kind of fighting that? I mean, Toronto's not a small market, but it's kind of treated like that or considered that or was for a while in the NBA. How much did the Pacers fight that with, you know, like you said, getting free agents or, you know, the Raptors? I mean, we've said it for years up here. You got to try to build the way the, you know, the 03 Pistons did with a lot of good players. We find out later some of those guys were superstars, but the team cohesion is such a big deal in when you don't have a, quote, star, unquote. How much are the Pacers kind of fighting that the same way a lot of other small market teams and Toronto was for a while?
Well, I'll start by saying I'm always laughing when, and I'm sure you do as well, when someone calls Toronto a small market. And I recall visiting your, you know, fabulous city and metropolitan area. It's not a small market, but it's the perception around the NBA and the shows on ESPN and how they just pick their five teams that they want to talk about all the time. And it just constantly you see them leave out a team like Indiana. Now, I think to get that respect, the Pacers as a franchise are in a position where you've got to earn it now. You've got to go do it in the playoffs because, you know, as someone who's with the team on a daily basis, I can get frustrated when they win, you know, 8 out of 10 games or knock off, you know, LeBron James at his first road loss of the season, basically, and not get the attention. It's more about what the other teams do than what the Pacers do. So the Pacers fight that. But I think they understand that you have to experience that postseason success. And in terms of free agency, they've done everything they can do. The training facility is one of the best in the NBA. I think Bankers Life Fieldhouse has aged better than any arena. They're already renovating it. You would never be able to tell someone that it was 20 years old, and they were still going to make it better. So in terms of facilities, it's a basketball market. They love their basketball here. They have a lot to offer. They just don't have the beach, and they don't have the huge city. But I don't know that the big city is as important. It's the weather and those kinds of things that both Indiana and Toronto sometimes have to deal with. So long-winded way of saying they battle it. They have to build from within, but they really need a group of players to embrace Indiana and let them maybe spread the word if they're trying to get a free agent. Malcolm Brogdon is going to be someone that everything, by all accounts, he really enjoys Indiana. And he might be someone that could recruit that key free agent if you need to in the next year or two.
Yeah, and I'll say I love going to Indy to go to the field house. I think it's top five, Jonesy, probably in the league, if not top three.
Yeah.
That's a great gym, and I'm shocked to hear it's 20 years old as well, because you always say, Jonesy, but going down to Utah, you could eat off the floor. It's so clean, and I would say the same thing in Indy. I don't think I'd be doing it now in a pandemic, but it's extremely clean and just a great sight lines and just a great gym to be in.
Yeah, you just hope the players feel that as well. I think what hurts sometimes is when you're in Indiana in January and it's cold, and you don't get to, you know, you think, I don't want to be here. And we are guilty of feeling that in Toronto at times when it's freezing cold. But the actual things that matter, the facilities, the people, the venue, the fan base, those things I would put up there with any other market.
Hey, Jeremiah, we appreciate the time today. Thanks for joining us.
Well, keep up the good work, guys. I'm glad to know that you guys have been finding things to talk about and stay busy during these crazy times, and I'm happy to do it. And we're happy to take one of your coaches. Maybe pick up the rivalry just a little bit between the Pacers and the Raptors.
Sounds good. All the best. Stay healthy.
Thanks, man.
All right. Thanks, Eric Paul.
There is Jeremiah Johnson, Pacers broadcaster. He's their TV sideline reporter and host on their broadcast, and we appreciate his time. We'll take the break, shift our attention from basketball to baseball, and go down memory lane a little bit here when we continue with former Blue Jay Ed Sprague on Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome back to Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. We're going to hook up with former Blue Jay, longtime major leaguer Ed Sprague in a couple of minutes. Jonesy, this gives us an opportunity to get into the conversation a little bit before we hook up with Ed on, again, the favorites. Because we pretty much dealt with the Raptors yesterday, and we didn't really get time to talk about Maple Leafs and Blue Jays. So what better time than to bring up some of the favorite Blue Jays? And I said to you, and again, folks, this kind of stems from a post put up by the Denver Nuggets talking about all-time favorites and not including an image of Carmelo Anthony. But make sure that we're clear in saying this is a conversation and a topic that was started by Denver about favorites, not best player of all time, because that's where these conversations can get skewed. We're not talking about the top five best or the top 10 best. It's the top 5, 10, whatever number it may be, favorites. And I tell you, when I was looking at the Raptors, now I know they're not as old in terms of their history, but when I compared the Raptors to the Jays to the Leafs, it was so difficult for me to pare down my Toronto Blue Jays list, because I came up with a bunch of Leafs. I can give you some of those names, but the Jays, I kept coming up with name after name after name after name when I think of fan favorites and people that made an impact, players that made an impact on this community, on this city, and just the jerseys you'd see in the stands around Exhibition Stadium, Skydome, Rogers Center. There are so many guys, Jonesy. Alomar, Halliday, Carter, Fernandez, Olerud, Delgado, McGriff, Borders, Garcia, Batista, Key, Henke, Steve, White, Guzman, Bell, Mosby, Upshaw, Witts, Donaldson, Encarnacion, and then guys like Marco Estrada, John McDonald, Ed Sprague. Like, the list goes on.
Yeah. It was ridiculous to try and, for me to try and pull out a list of Jays, because I also had the good fortune of when All Sports TV started in Canada, carrying the bag for my brother as he was, you know, carving out his career. And I was a teacher tagging along for the experience. And, you know, like one of our guys, Scott Carson, is still in the booth after, I don't know, about 35 million years. And I'm with you, E. I started a list just up names off the top of my head, guys that I used to love to go down to the park and see, and like, just, they'd have a word about anything, you know, about music, like, you know, guys like, well, there was Danny Ainge in the early days. I got to meet, know Danny, and we talked a lot of basketball. He'd come out and play pickup with us. David Wells, Todd Stottlemyre. Like, these are guys that, you know, Dave Winfield played basketball at the University of Minnesota. And we, like, there were, I would go down there and talk about everything. It's like, oh yeah, we are here for baseball. So I couldn't do it. I just my list, you named all those guys. I just threw three guys in that you didn't name that were on my list, that might have been on your list. And then I started to do the same thing with hockey. I was alive the last time the Leafs won a cup. And I can't narrow it down. And in that era, the Argos were huge too. And I thought, okay, let me throw in my top 10 Argo guys of all time. And it's so hard to do. And it's amazing to look back and look at the World Series now and think, you know, how close the Jays had won it and how close they were a few years ago. And now they're trying to ramp it up again.
Well, when we talk about the top players in franchise history and favorite players in franchise history, there's no denying that this was one of the top moments. I don't know if it's top three, top five, top ten, but it's right there. It's certainly a moment that every Blue Jay fan will remember. In 1992, in the 92 World Series, Ed Sprague with that big home run off Jeff Reardon, and it was just a few days ago, the 28-year anniversary. I can't believe it's been that long, but 92. Wow. And to talk about that moment and just kind of reminisce a little bit, he, you know, obviously a veteran major league player who had a long career, but he will always be in this market remembered as a Toronto Blue Jay. He's the current director of player development for the Oakland Athletics, Ed Sprague. Ed, thanks for the time today.
Hey, my pleasure, guys.
Hey, Ed, before we talk about the home run itself and all the moments connected to it, I'm going to be the one to admit that, and I'm guilty of this, for forgetting about the fact that if we go back to the ALCS, you were the one, and I apologize, I'm starting on a bit of a negative note, but it was certainly a catalyst to what ultimately came and then the momentum that built for the Blue Jays. You were the one that got punched out by Dennis Eckersley and the big fist pump and the stare down and all the theatrics and then the benches, you know, brewing and bubbling over and everything. That moment itself, and then it carries over to Alomar the next inning hitting the home run. What was that moment like, and did that sort of feel like in the moment a lightning rod to what ultimately came for Alomar and what came for your team through to the World Series as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Obviously, Eckersley was in the prime of, you know, what he was doing. He was, you know, he was really good at his job at the end of the game. And I think, you know, when he punched me out and looked over, I think our dugout took offense to it and, you know, kind of lit a little fire under us. And then obviously Robbie had the big homer next inning to put us over the top.
Ed, when you think about your home run, I'm sure something you'll never forget. Can you kind of take us back and walk us through the situation and what you were thinking and all of that. I mean, the play, the home run itself was a silencer. It was massive. Just for people that have just seen it and don't know anything about it, walk us through some of the stuff that was in your mind, and like, were you sitting on a pitch? Like, walk us through it, Ed.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to, obviously, it was game one of the ALCS when I got a pinch hit off Eckersley in game one. You know, it wasn't a safe situation. We got a base hit. And then, you know, Cito had some trust in me to be in those situations. Came in, I knew I was going to hit for Dwayne Ward going into that inning. Knew Reardon was probably going to be coming in the game, and talked to Rance Mullenix, and he kind of gave me a little scout report on him that he likes to elevate the fastball. So I was definitely looking for a fastball. I was more of a low ball hitter, so I was trying to get it down the zone. And I debated swinging at taking the first pitch, because Derek Bell had just walked in front of me. And so I just, I was kind of taught early by the veteran guys, when you come off the bench, to be aggressive. And that's what I did. And to be honest with you, I never really gave it a thought that it was my first World Series at bat, or given the situation. It was, looking back, it was probably one of the more relaxing at bats of my career, and was fortunate to hit it where I wanted to hit it.
You know, it's interesting you say that, Ed, talking to Ed Sprague. I went back a little bit earlier this morning, and I was watching a portion of an interview you did a few months back with Dan Shulman, and I wanted to ask you about that very point that you just made, how relaxed you were. Any reason why you think you were that relaxed? Not having ever been there myself, and never will be, you would think from the outside looking in, young athlete, biggest stage in the world, veteran pitcher on the mound, you know, tight, high-pressure moment, and you're saying you're as relaxed maybe as you'd ever been. Why do you think that was?
Yeah, I can say relaxed. I can say focused. You know, I was very fortunate to play in two College World Series and win those. So, I mean, at the time, those are big at-bats in your career as an amateur. I was able to play in the Olympics and play some big games against Cuba on the Pan Am team. You know, my amateur career, I had a lot of big at-bats and moments that at the time, you know, were the pinnacle of where you could be at that given level. So I think that had something to do with it. You know, like I said, my experience in college and at Stanford, and then playing for, you know, three U.S. teams, and then, you know, winning the gold medal in South Korea. So I think all those moments kind of accumulated in that one event, but I was just really just playing the game for what it was, and I was just, you know, they say take it one moment at a time. I think that's what I was doing.
Hey, Ed, when you look at the game and the way it's kind of changed, I mean, you know, Eric and I are basketball guys, and we look at what, you know, the move away from big men have done, and the three-point shot, you know, they've changed the rules in hockey. The clutching and grabbing is gone. It's more freewheeling. What, in the last, you know, 15, 20 years, even dating back to your World Series championships, what do you think some of the biggest changes in the game have been to, you know, from, you know, player standpoint? I know you're a player personnel guy. In terms of moving it forward, what have you seen that, you know, this is really good and it's really helped our game?
Well, I mean, I think it's exciting. I mean, obviously they've moved towards the home run. I mean, I think the analytics have proven that, you know, getting on base and slugging is important. So that's what you're seeing. You're seeing a lot of walks, you're seeing a lot of homers, but with that goes a lot of strikeouts. On the pitching side, you're seeing a lot of power arms. So that matches up with, you know, the home run and all this stuff. And the shifting, you know, requires guys to try to beat the shift over their head. You know, you don't see a lot of guys, bat control guys, moving the ball around. You see it a little bit more in the playoffs now than you have in recent years. I don't know if it makes our game more exciting. I think, you know, when there's a few home runs hit, that's exciting. But there is some downtime that, you know, I think doesn't interest a lot of people. You know, so I don't know if the game's better or worse. It is exciting to watch, you know, guys hit home runs, and, you know, the ball is certainly lively, and you have some great athletes making great plays on defense. And so it's exciting to watch from my end, but it definitely is, the game has changed. But I do appreciate, you know, guys like Freddie Freeman who move the ball around the yard and situationally hit, that can hit a home run, but will beat the shift if they need to. And I think those type of players, and Mookie Betts is certainly one of those guys as well. I think the best teams have a combination of they're gonna slug it out when they need to, but given situational hitting, when the game's on the line, they're not afraid to, you know, hit a ground ball through the hole.
speaking with Ed Sprague. Ed, as Jonesy noted, as a couple of basketball guys, we often get caught in conversations with folks, and I know that the coaches and players often hate to hear it, the analytics and the crunching of the numbers and everything else. How has analytics changed in baseball with the preparation for players and just scouting reports and guys going into games, knowing that much more and maybe knowing too much about opposing pitchers, about tendencies and trends and everything else? How has that changed over the course of your career and your career into coaching as well?
Well, I mean, I think obviously it came on the scene and you got a lot of smart people giving, you know, a lot of old-time baseball people the data. And then you need someone to translate that, you know, for the players, and then from the coaching standpoint, you need to, you know, obviously need to find out what players can handle what information. But it's been around a long time now, so I think there's a little bit of a balance between, you know, what's given down to the coaches and the manager and how that information gets disseminated. And I think the players like the information. I think players are starting to learn what information is valuable for them particularly. But you can overwhelm them, you know. So it's important on how it's presented. It's a lot of good information, but it still comes down to execution. You know, you can have the greatest game plan on earth analytically and how it should play out with matchups and everything else, but the game's still played in between the lines. You have to execute pitches, and you have to square the ball up and run the base as well. So I think it's coming back to a good balance, and I think the teams that make that balance work are the successful ones. Get a lot of information, have a lot of great coaches that can – take that information and pare it down to knowing their personnel and how to use it.
Ed, in your job and when you look at, you know, players and trying to find those diamonds, I mean, there's those guys that are out there. There's the obvious ones, but you're looking for other guys too. What kinds of things are you looking for? What are the automatics that kids got A, B, C, and, you know, maybe nobody knows about them? We're going to put them on our radar. What are some of those things?
Yeah, I think given the information and the video and the scouting and, you know, the data, I think it's, you know, it's harder to find diamonds in the rough. I think each team, you know, values certain things maybe a little bit differently and how those things fit in with each club and how they're trying to find that extra piece. Obviously, power arms are important. I think the ability to hit the ball hard is important as well. It depends whether you're talking about trying to add a piece at the big league level or if you're talking about getting guys out of the amateur draft. And, you know, all these showcases have data and information. I mean, we were able to put together a draft, not just us here in Oakland, but obviously the whole industry, without any scouts getting out and seeing guys, which is remarkable, and without a college season or high school seasons being played. And I think some good players still got chosen, and we'll see how that plays out in the next few years. But these players are that you're getting now, they're educated. They know what teams are looking for. They're grown up in this era of analytics and data. They're seeing it on, you know, MLB Network, and they hear it talked about. So they come into the game having an expectation of what teams are looking for and how that data, they can speak the language.
Speaking with Ed Sprague, Ed, last one for you here. Just as a fan of the game in general, watching the World Series right now, thinking back to your time in 92, 93 as well, I don't think we're ever going to be able to, obviously, you know, replicate the absence of 40, 50,000 fans screaming down on you in the stands. But the one thing I've appreciated just as a fan, and I'd be interested to see if you agree, is we saw it in the NBA. It's hard to kind of tell if it was the case in the NHL just because of the way the game's played and the boards and the glass and everything else. But it seemed like in the NBA, the players were that much more engaged on the benches. And I'm seeing it in baseball now, too. The players seem to be that much more involved in terms of cheering on the teammates and getting into the game and just kind of being active because they're creating that energy for their guys without the fans in the stands. I love seeing it because it almost brings back to just being a kid and being on the diamond and just playing for the love of the game. And I feel like, you know, maybe I'm being too kumbaya here, but it just feels like it's almost more pure right now what we're seeing as opposed to what we've seen so many other times in the past.
Yeah, I think it's been there. I think but without, you know, the shots generally go to the crowd going crazy, right? And
right.
You can't really hear the reaction from the dugout. I think those reactions have been there, but I think the crowd reaction has overwhelmed the dugout or the bench reaction. And I think the camera crew now, you know, they're looking for a live shot. They're going to the bench, right? Where before they would, you know, maybe they're you know, going to a family section, or maybe they're going to the crazy fan who caught the ball, or whatever happened in those situations. So I think it's still there, but I agree. I think it's you know, cool, you know, going through this bubble, and I was at our alt site, and, you know, guys are, you're seeing guys together every single day. So there's certainly a lot of camaraderie that more so than these guys have ever had, probably. It probably feels a little more like when they're amateurs in college and playing, where you're, you know, you're staying in the same dorm or the same frat house, or we're living together and you're with them 24/7. There's no distraction of family and other obligations. You really come together as a club. And I think that's what you're seeing in these playoffs, is that, you know, these guys have been grinding it for 2-3 months now to get through to this stage. And I think that's why you see just the camaraderie and the excitement every time someone does something good.
Hey, Ed, we appreciate the time today, and thanks for going down memory lane with us a little bit as well. All the best.
All right. Thanks, guys.
There is a longtime major leaguer and former Toronto Blue Jay, of course, Ed Sprague. 28 years ago, the home run in the 92 World Series, one of the top moments in Blue Jays history. We'll take the break, come back with more Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Back on Smith & Jones, Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you, getting set to wrap things up. Baseball Central comes up shortly at the top of the hour. And then, of course, it's Writer's Block as Game 2 of the World Series goes tonight, with the Dodgers leading 1-0 following their victory last night. And crazy to think, Jonesy, and it could continue for Tampa in the National Football League with Tom Brady as well. But right now, you got the champs in L.A. and in the NBA, the champs in Tampa in hockey. It's going to be L.A. or Tampa in baseball. And, well, we'll see if it follow suit in football as well.
I saw something today about that. With everywhere Tom Brady's been, they've won. Interesting. Every city. Well, Boston.
Hope not. Yeah.
I hope not.
Yeah, I hope not too. All right. More Smith & Jones tomorrow at 1 p.m. Thanks to Ed Sprague and Jeremiah Johnson. Baseball Central's next on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.